Good afternoon. The Portland City Council in session Thursday, 2 p.m. on July 23rd, 2009. We'll come to order. Carla, will you please call the roll?
Saltzman?
Here.
Leonard?
Here.
Fritz?
Here.
Fish?
Here.
Adams?
Here. We have an item that was held over. Why don't we take that first? Could you please read the title for council calendar item?
1026. Authorize contracts for hauling and disposal of non-hazardous contaminated media and hazardous waste.
Oh, Commissioner Saltzman.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I understand this item was held over yesterday. There were some questions about minority women, emerging small business participation in these contracts. This ordinance actually authorizes us to go put these things out to bid. There's not any contracts being awarded yet. That will be subsequent to this, and you can be assured that purchasing and BES will be doing the most we can to maximize participation of minority women and emerging small businesses.
Thank you for the clarification. Additional information. Is there any council discussion? Is there anyone in the room that would like to testify on this matter? Carla, will you please call the roll?
Saltzman?
Aye.
Leonard?
Aye.
Fritz?
Aye.
Fish?
Aye.
Adams?
Aye. Approved. That gets us to, we have three time certains today, so we will need to be efficient. The time certain for 2 o'clock is a non-emergency ordinance. Carla, would you please read the title for council calendar item 1028?
Authorize intergovernmental agreement with Metro for ongoing parks and recreation management of Metro-acquired natural area properties.
Commissioner Fish.
Thank you, Mayor. I'm pleased to introduce this intergovernmental agreement with Metro this afternoon. The IGA Forest builds on our successful management partnership, which began with the 1995 Regional Open Spaces Bond Measure and continued with the 2006 Metro Bond Measure. I'd like to begin by acknowledging the leadership of my colleague, friend, and former Parks Commissioner Dan Saltzman, whose leadership led to council adoption of a resolution in 2006 that affirmed the city's commitment to fund the management of natural areas acquired by Metro within Portland's boundaries. Over the past 14 years, Metro has acquired over 500 acres of natural areas throughout Portland that are maintained by Portland Parks and Recreation. This IGA before us covers almost 600 acres of land already managed by Portland Parks and adds 136 new acres to our local responsibility. We are particularly excited about adding the Clatsop Buttes natural area to our inventory. With this addition, a long-held vision of creating a large signature natural area in outer southeast Portland is quickly becoming a reality. In one of its first purchases with the 2006 Natural Areas Bond Funds, Metro moved quickly to purchase 100 acres adjacent to natural areas already owned by the city. Since then, Portland Parks, BES, and Metro have continued to add acreage piece by piece. Taken altogether, in the area we now refer to as the East Buttes, which includes Powell Butte, Clatsop Butte, and Scouter, as in Boy Scout Mountain, Portland will soon be managing over 800 acres of open space. This IGA not only adds natural areas to the city's inventory, it also implements parks goals as well as the city's sustainability goals, including watershed health, active living, and energy conservation, and it opens opportunities for partnership with the city's Greater Green program in invasive species management and tree planting. I'd like to recognize and thank David Bragdon, Metro Chair, for his partnership in acquiring natural areas for our community and for his leadership in launching the Regional Intertwine Initiative. At this point, it's my honor to invite both Zary Santner, our Parks Director, and David Bragdon up to say a few words, and they'll be followed by one panel. David and Zary.
Good afternoon. Welcome. Glad you're here.
Afternoon, Mayor, members of the council.
Zary Santner, Director of Parks and Recreation. As Commissioner Fish mentioned, this ordinance is to authorize an interagency agreement between City of Portland Parks and Recreation and Metro for ongoing management of the Metro-acquired land within the city with funding from both measures that were passed in 1995 and 2006. The recent acquisition by Metro is helping the city to achieve the goals of Parks 2020 by preserving, protecting, and restoring Portland's natural resources to provide nature in the city and responding to the needs of our growing community for additional trails and parks in underserved areas. These acquisitions are consistent with the previously approved, council-approved recreational trail and natural acquisition strategies. As mentioned by Commissioner Fish, the 2006 resolution anticipated the need to fund ongoing operation and maintenance for properties purchased in the upcoming regional bond measure. Today's ordinance requests $238,000 for the ongoing maintenance of the 130 acres of new management responsibilities shown in orange in the maps that have been given to you. We appreciate the Metro. We appreciate that Metro has been able to purchase these lands and do the initial stabilizing work to improve the condition of these sites and to get them ready for our management. They have become a great addition to the regional intertwine. The properties under this IGA will become a permanent part of over 7,000 acres of natural land and miles of trails within Portland Park City Nature Portfolio. Our zone managers are ecologists, volunteer coordinators, and many of the City Nature staff will work with our friends groups, neighborhood associations, and partners such as BES to improve the conditions of these lands, to protect their resource values, and to, where appropriate, to make them available and connect people to nature. This IGA also includes agreement on management responsibility for Springwater on Willamette and Three Bridges on Springwater. The land for these trails was purchased as part of the 1995 bond measure. Through regional partnership, Portland Parks was able to secure the funding to design and build those trails, and they are now part of our system. We look forward to additional and future partnership with Metro for acquisition of natural areas and trails, and it is my great pleasure to introduce President of Metro Council, David Bragdon.
Okay. Thank you, Mayor and Commissioners. This continues the partnership that has been going on for many years. Most recently, your action in March of 06 as we were putting this ballot measure together and the agreements that we reached at that time. Commissioner Saltzman was Parks Commissioner at that time back in March of 06, and we set out our objectives in terms of acquisition that we would do and then management that the city would take on. That's been going very well at a good pace, and so this is a good step to take the next steps on that. The measure has provided, in terms of the regional share, about $35 million worth of acquisition that our agency has been able to do within the city limits of Portland. And as mentioned, the most significant of that recently is about $13 million in Clatsop Buttes. And I remember in March of 06, speaking before this council and Commissioner Leonard afterwards saying, well, you got me when you started talking about Johnson Creek, that we had added Johnson Creek to this measure. And it wasn't long after that that Mayor Adams, who was then commissioner of BES, summoned me into his office and unfurled a big aerial map, you remember that you have, or a photograph of Johnson Creek, and you talked about your Greater Green Initiative, and you said, what can you do here? What can we do there? And sure enough, here we are, you know, less than 2 years later, talking about what we've actually done on Clatsop Butte. So I want to acknowledge what's been going on there. But there are other parts of the city that have benefited greatly. Arnold Creek, Tryon Creek, the Springwater and Willamette Trail that Ms. Santner mentioned. And we're also going to be working on acquisitions in the Columbia Slough. So geographically, you know, this is spread all over the city. And the additions to Forest Park number in the hundreds of acres now. In addition, while we're talking today about the lands that we've acquired, the 1995 measure provided $7 million directly to the City of Portland for your own city projects. This most recent measure will also include $15 million in that same category. So when you take all of those you're talking about upwards of $57 million in capital being invested in the natural environment here within the city limits of Portland. And we do that jointly with you. It's all public money. It's all coming from the taxpayers. We all work for the same taxpayers, and we all try to do our jobs for them. Part of the issue, of course, when you do capital investment is taking care of what we have, and that's why this partnership has been so important, understanding that a lot of these parcels are next to parcels that you already own and manage. It makes sense for you to do that, and makes sense for us to stick with the things that we're good at in terms of the acquisition program. This agreement really just codifies what's been going on sort of on an ad hoc basis, one agreement after another. And as we've worked together, we realized, well, we should just have this master agreement, and just this is the way we're going to do things. And it's a sign that our agencies are working closer together. So I'd really recommend this ordinance for your consideration and adoption, and look forward to continuing to work with you.
Well, in my 3.5 years as Environmental Services Commissioner, your response to that particular meeting was more than enthusiastic, and you put cash behind the words that you're talking about today. And you've got much to look back on in your time as leader of Metro, but of all the Metro leaders I've worked with, I mean, this is far and above anything anyone has ever done, and I want to thank you for your great partnership.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you,
David, and I want to acknowledge Jim Desmond, who is here.
Right.
Jim, just raise your hand if you could.
Hey, Jim. Thanks, Jim.
Mayor, we have one panel. This will be brief, but there's so we've invited testimony from Mike Houck of the Urban Green Spaces Institute, Margot Barnett, Friends of Maricara Natural Area, and Frank D. Gregorio, Friends of Clatsop Buttes Natural Area. Yeah. Thank you all for joining us, and if you could take up to 2 minutes each, and we look forward to hearing from you.
My name is Mike Houck. I'm here representing the Urban Green Spaces Institute, and we support this IGA based on the following tenets. First of all, it's very clear as you talk to citizens throughout the region, they really don't care who owns a particular piece of property. They want access to nature and to recreational opportunities near home and near their work. They also expect responsible environmental stewardship of publicly owned lands. Secondly, adding additional natural areas to Portland Park's portfolio is consistent with Park's Vision 2020 that calls for significant addition of natural areas to the city's park system and for increased efforts in environmental stewardship. Third, the IGA supports several cities' initiatives, which you've already alluded to, Climate Action Plan, Greater Green, Watershed Plan, Urban Forest Management, and invasive species removal efforts, and the city's overall goal to become an ecologically sustainable city. The discussion about maintenance has come up, and we were very pleased in 06 when you committed to recognizing that these areas are going to need maintenance. As with the city's gray infrastructure, natural areas also require management. The difference between gray and green infrastructure, however, is that the investment, both capital and maintenance, in green infrastructure pays back many times for every dollar spent in multiple benefits related to climate change, human health, ecosystem health, and property values and quality of life. That said, I assume you're all aware, the intertwined has been referenced several times today. That's our effort that David Bragdon launched a couple of years ago to create the world's greatest park, trail, and natural area system. One of the objectives of that program is to develop a region-wide approach to securing funding to manage these truly regional natural area assets. So while the city obviously needs to stand behind allocating funding for maintaining this green infrastructure, we're working very hard at the regional level to try to figure out how to crack that nut, and that's been an issue that's been on the table for a number of years, and David, Jim, and others are working very hard to do that.
Thank you, Mike.
Hi, I'm Margot Barnett, and I'm here representing a very loosely organized group of individuals who have volunteered for years working on Maricara Natural Area. I really appreciate being invited to come and talk to you today about this IGA. Stewardship of the natural areas purchased with Metro Bond Measure Funds is a critical piece of the Regional Natural Area Program. And I know from volunteering on the campaigns for both of the Metro Bond Measures that the public is only willing to support acquisition if they feel like the properties that are purchased are maintained. And so that this is really, that is a critical piece, and the IGA for maintenance is very important. My experience working on Maricara Park, a 17-acre natural area park, half owned by Portland Parks and half purchased with Metro funds from the 1995 bond measure 2626, has shown the value of the type of partnership and management described in the IGA. When I first started working on this property as a volunteer, half of it was actually still owned by Portland Public Schools, and to be able to go in there and do stewardship, I had to arrange to get in writing to get permission every time I wanted to have a work party. So I had to get permission in writing from Portland Public Schools as well as contacting Portland Parks. So clearly, once the other half was purchased by Metro, the maintenance in terms of volunteering became a much simpler operation. And it was really wonderful that when the school district was considering selling their portion of the natural area, which contained a wooded wetland area, it was really fortuitous that there was still funds available to purchase this property from the 1995 bond measure. This had been identified as one of the important natural areas as part of the Tryon linkages. The maintenance agreement between Portland Parks and Metro for this park has greatly simplified public involvement for stewardship. Through joint efforts between volunteers, City Nature staff, and funding of the Protect the Best program, we've managed to almost completely eradicate ivy, blackberry, and clematis and other invasives in this park, so it's really been a tremendous experience. Key to the agreement is recognition that funding for operations and maintenance must be provided so stewardship can assure that the natural areas are maintained to protect the investment that was made when they were acquired. Consolidation of the previous agreements that were made when each property was acquired eliminates the short-term nature of a lot of those agreements, and so it makes it a much more beneficial arrangement for the city as well, so that investments made in planning, management, and improvements to the properties is something that's really of greater value for the cities, and it's much more fiscally viable to have those extended agreements as opposed to just an agreement that closes out after a set period of time. So I really think that this is a wonderful thing to be happening, and I support it strongly. Thank you.
Margo, thanks for all that you do for our park system. And Frank?
Yes, hi. Good afternoon, Mr. Mayor, Commissioners. I'm also pleased to show support for Metro and the Portland Parks getting together to help with the management of the acquired property. As stated, my name is Frank DiGregorio, and I'm a resident and homeowner in Outer Southeast Portland. Recently, I've actually had the opportunity to serve as a citizen committee member for the East Portland Action Plan. I come here today to show support for the land acquisition by Metro and for the management of that land by the Portland and Parks and Recreation Department. I live in a small 19-home dead-ended subdivision known as Day Spring. It is essentially surrounded by the land now known as Clatsop Butte Nature Area. And like many stories, the story how it came to be that the 130 acres that makes up now what is known as Clatsop Butte Nature Park is actually much more than just the purchase of some property by Metro. It's actually the story of many individual citizens who banded together to bring to the attention of the city and Metro officials the importance that this piece of land has to the region and to the city's citizens. This particular property drains directly into the second largest free-flowing body of water in the city limits, which is Johnson Creek. And I know that years from now, future citizens of Portland will say something to the effect of, wow, those people that preserve this land really did the city and its citizens a great favor. As I told Mr. Bragdon when he called my wife and I to inform us about the purchase of the land by Metro, it made me feel actually proud and glad to pay my taxes. I feel as though the land serves as a significant visible testimony that sometimes great things happen when people collectively get together and accomplish a common goal for the greater good. I hope that someday that maybe some of you might be interested in the tale of how my neighbors and I became involved in the acquisition of what we like to think of as the East Side Forest Park. And I know that someday it will serve as an example of how nature can come back from near annihilation since the area was due to be developed and there was a lot of development going on in that particular area. It also reveals how an ecosystem can revive itself And it's already filled with many indigenous plant and animal species. With Leech Botanical Gardens to its west and the Brownwood Stream Restoration Project to the east, it is just a matter of time before we get a glimpse of what the first settlers may have seen when they first made their roots here. Personally, I'm hoping that someday we'll be able to see an eagle or two, as I understand that they lived in the area some hundreds of years ago. Also, I know that people will say those guys did it right when they actually come out and walk the property and walk the Springwater Trail to see what's being done to restore it. Recently, the same group that spearheaded the effort to get Metro to consider purchasing the Clatsopute Nature Area, we went back to work and we created a new group, which we have named Friends of Clatsopute. We have only had a couple of meetings so far. We had our first official duties where we did a cleanup along what is Barbara Welsh Road from Clatsop down to Foster Road, and we've actually been doing that every year. It's part of the SOLVE project, so we've incorporated that into what the duties of the Friends of Clatsopute will be. I've actually been named as the president of Clatsopute Nature Area, or Friends of Clatsopute, I should say, and I think that's mostly because no one else wanted the job, and also because I think most of us were exhausted after all the work that we put into getting it looked at, purchased, and preserved. Anyway, the group focus for Friends of Clatsopute will be to help restore the land through various efforts to what it used to be, and the first project that we're actually embarking on starting this fall is going to start to appraise the invasive species that are there and start to pull them out and get rid of that to help restore the area. And I think with that, that's all I really have to say, and I'm very pleased to be part of this whole thing, and I am glad that the city is going to take over management, and I'm very, very happy that Metro purchased the property.
Thank you. Thank you for your service. We have lots of friends groups, none that we are more eagerly anticipating working with than the new friends group. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you all very much for your testimony. Appreciate your time. Is anyone signed up to testify?
We have one more person, Catherine Houston.
All right. Any additional council discussion? Carla, would you please call the roll?
This is a non-emergency.
I'm sorry, you're right. This moves to a second reading next week.
Mayor, if I could, since we'll be losing a number of people, I just want to thank Deborah Lev, who I have not had a chance to acknowledge, Parks Project Manager, for her superb work as well. Thanks to all for coming today.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. That moves us to the 2:30 time certain. We're on time. Can you please read the title for Council Calendar Item 1029?
Accept the 2009 Use of Force by the Portland Police Bureau Follow-Up Report.
That's your rule.
Good afternoon. Hello. Welcome to the council chambers. You want to pull up a chair?
One additional, yeah.
You want to pull up a chair, sir?
Sure.
Come on. Okay. Let's see, who's the sponsor? Auditors. Good to have you here again.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, Mayor Adams and Commissioners. Levon Griffin-Vallade, City Auditor. I'm here today to introduce the follow-up of the 2007 Force Task Force Report. This follow-up represents the joint efforts of the Portland Police Bureau, the Independent Police Review Division, and the Citizen Review Committee. And as you may recall, the Independent Police Review Division, better known as IPR, is an independent, impartial oversight agency within the City Auditor's Office and was established in 2001 to help improve police accountability, promote higher standards, and increase public confidence. The Citizen Review Committee is an advisory body to IPR. So the Force Task Force follow-up report released last Tuesday shows that the Bureau has been responsive to recommendations made by the 2007 task force. The overall reduction in the use of force and other improvements are commendable, positive indicators. The report does show that there are areas that need ongoing monitoring and review, whether that comes from the Audit Services Division or IPR in my office or from the Bureau itself. Use of force is and always will be an area of risk for the city and for the public. And like other areas of risk, It's important to continue to push for greater transparency and improvement. So without any further ado, because we have lots of conversation to have here, I will turn the discussion over to Mary Beth Baptista, Director of IPR, Michael Bigham, who is the Chair of the Citizen Review Committee, and Portland Police Chief Rosie Sizer. Thank you.
Ms. Baptista, welcome.
Good afternoon. I am the Director of IPR, Mary Beth Baptista, and I was pleased to have the opportunity to chair the second task force. The task force included two members of the community, Chair Michael Bigham from the CRC, as well as other CRC member Lauren Erickson. We also had the management of the IPR present, as well as many representatives from the Bureau, including the director of and staff of the Office of Accountability and Professional Standards. Part one of the report that you have details the Bureau's efforts to implement 16 recommendations. These 16 recommendations came from the original FORCE task force, which was convened in November of 06, and then the report was released in April of 07. So this task force efforts, first part of the report, we looked at what the Bureau has done to implement each of those recommendations. The Bureau provided us a binder of information, as well as had commanders come and speak directly to us, as well as other Bureau members to talk about the work that they have done to implement those recommendations. The task force found that the Bureau fulfilled their part of the bargain and implemented each of the recommendations. There was also recommendations to IPR that was also determined that we implemented. The significant accomplishments include that the data force collection report was actually revised, and that allows the Bureau to publicly report and make benchmark comparisons to other jurisdictions. The entire force policy was revised. It defined the reasonableness standard and encourages de-escalation. And it's also led to greater accountability and increased sustained findings when officers are found out of policy. It also requires crisis intervention training for all officers to improve officers' ability to work with people who are in crisis, and requires debriefing in all citizen or Bureau initiated force complaint allegations, whether or not those allegations are dismissed by IPR. The part two of the report presents data submitted on that data collection report form in a 12-month time period. In response to community concerns, the task force also reported on Portland's use of force compared to peer jurisdictions. We also looked at force statistics broken down by racial characteristics and gender, and we also included incidents involving pointing a firearm. The accomplishments here include that force complaints are down 58% since 2004. The annual rate of less lethal impact is down 72%. And injuries from force encounters are down for both civilians and officers. I'm encouraged by the work done by the Bureau under the leadership of Chief Sizer. The Bureau's work is commendable and demonstrates proactive leadership and a dedicated workforce. I'd also like to thank the members of the task force for their diligence and careful consideration. Their thoughtful analysis and the time that they committed was certainly commendable. And with that said, I'd like to turn the microphone over to Michael Bigham.
Welcome, Mr. Bigham.
Hi.
Glad you're here. Thanks for your service.
Thank you. My name is Michael Bigham. I'm the chair of the Citizen Review Committee. And I've been on working through this process for the last 3 years. And it hasn't been an easy process. There's been some frank and honest discussions and some hard discussions with everybody involved. But I think there are substantial results that are very encouraging. I think there, in my view, there are three main accomplishments. One is the change in the force policy to the least amount of force necessary to do the job without endangering the safety of the officers. That's a remarkable change, and it's a leading edge change with the other police departments in the country. There's increased transparency. The police department, police bureau, is releasing statistics that most other police departments won't release. And there is a reduction in injuries of both officers and suspects. I think that's dramatic change. But I also think this is a continuing process and that we need to continue monitoring the police bureau from the community and from the council to make sure that these changes are kept over time. And I think there are some things pointed out in the report that require further study. One is the effects of race and gender in terms of the use of force. And I also wanted to applaud the auditor for starting an audit of the use of tasers. I think that's important to take a look at. I'd like to thank Mary Beth Baptista and her staff, and Chief Sizer and her staff, and then my compatriot on the panel, Lauren Erickson, for all their hard work and honest discussion. And now I'll turn the microphone over to Chief Sizer.
Chief Sizer, welcome.
Hi, my name is Rosie Sizer, and I'm Portland Police Chief, and I'm very happy with this report, both for the fact that it was accomplished, and second, for the fact that it records so many accomplishments on the part of the Portland Police Bureau. In very few words, it documents the fact that we are using less force, receiving less force complaints, and injuries to suspects and officers alike are reduced. I think the changes that we enact really over the course of 2007 and 2008 were substantial. It was extremely hard work, and it was unsettling work as well. But I think that process of collaboration both within the Portland Police Bureau and with our partners at IPR and the CRC really produced exceptionally good work, and it's measured here today. I think it's important to point out that force is something that is an inevitable part of police work, but it's increasingly rare. This report documents that in the roughly 400,000 annual calls for service that the Portland Police Bureau produces, that 0.27% of 1% result in a use of force, and only 3% of arrests result in a use of force. So I think, unlike the images that you see on TV and characterize sometimes on in print media as well, force is something that we do, but it's something that we increasingly do rarely. And then finally, I think it's important for us to continue to document our work. I think there are two issues that are very important to our community and communities around the country. One involves race relations, and one involves the use of force. And it's something that we can never rest on our laurels with. It's something that we have to self-examine continuously and work with our workforce to provide the best quality public safety services with the fewest negative impacts.
I have two questions. On the use of force, sort of if you could summarize in your own words what you attribute the success to, sort of what are the top three things that you think have been the most successful?
Well, I don't think it's any one thing, and we implemented 15 recommendations, and they were all thoughtfully considered. I think it was important for us to provide crisis intervention training to every patrol officer and sergeant. I think police training in the past has been heavy on law and tactics and light on communications, and I think that kind of really principled communication training is something that is a baseline for good police officers. I think it was important for us to change our force policy to express our aspiration that whenever possible we de-escalate and that we attempt to use less than the maximum force allowable by law. Sometimes the law allows us to do things that are lawful but seem awful. And so I think it was important to give expression to that. It was important to train that to our workforce as well. So those two things were highly important. The third change that I think was important is we created in the operational divisions teams of officers and sergeants who semi-annually review use of force reports. And what they're looking are for trends within their division of new tactics that may be emerging that either the chief's office or the training division don't necessarily know are happening. They look for ways to improve reporting of force incidents, and they also look for opportunities to provide training and counseling to officers who are may not as skillful at using force. And that could be that they are underusing force or not making timely decisions, which sometimes can result in more force at the 11th hour of an episode. I think those things are three of a number of changes that we have made, but I think collectively it seems to have made a difference. So it's important to affect, I think, good policy changes, and it's important to monitor whether or not what seems like a good idea is in fact a good idea.
So the second question has to do with the comments that we've heard about race and gender relations and improving that. What are your priorities, and what's a sense of timeline on acting on those priorities?
Well, I think it's important to look not just at use of force incidents in the aggregate, but look at it as it applies to race and gender. I think the greatest disproportionality in the application of force is we use force far more frequently against males than females. Does that mean we're underusing force with females and overusing force? I don't necessarily think so, but it's something to think about. And the same thing goes with race, to, whenever possible, make the application of force when we have to use it as unbiased as possible. And I think this study of how we use force really complements our racial profiling plan and our discussion as race and bias in the decisions that we make.
And can you tick off some of the priorities then for further implementing the change on race and gender?
I think we expect to be here next month to talk about that. Part of it is to continue to study what seems to be the causations. There is in this document a fairly level application of force across racial lines when compared to arrests, with the exception of a small disproportionality among African Americans. We need to study that more. We think it mainly has to do with pepper spraying, and we think it mainly has to do with pepper spraying in the entertainment district on, you know, busy Thursday, Friday, and Saturday nights, where you have the crush of people and sometimes inebriated people. So part of it is I'm not sure that we're prepared to implement a plan. We need more study of this topic.
Actually, for a council work session next month on the chief's racial profiling plan and other related issues.
Great. Thank you, Chief. Other Mayor, conversation? Commissioner Fritz, then Commissioner Fish.
First, thank you all for your leadership in each of your roles. You're obviously very dedicated to addressing this problem and making things better. I had a question in the report. It says that use of force reports are now only required for control holds when they cause injury. Reports are no longer required for physical controls like handcuffing, pressure points, and control holds that do not cause injury. These changes have substantially reduced the overall number of force reports. So are we sure that we are... we actually have reduced the use of force, or we're just reporting it differently?
There is some of both. Some of the reductions is because changes in reporting requirements. Some of the reduction is simply reductions in the use of force. And you can really tease out that information by the type that is of force that is used. For example, pepper spray, tasers, beanbag rounds, none of those reporting requirements changed at all. Where I changed the requirement was really in terms of physical control. We had made a decision when we started completing use of force reports that we would not require a use of force report for a handcuffing. Almost inevitably, handcuffing involves a control hold. It's generally called a reverse wrist lock. And so it's very difficult to provide a bright line for officers for why is a reverse wrist lock into handcuffing a use of force, but another move that we train called a sankajo isn't. And so what we attempted to do was to be more similar to other agencies that publicly report on force and to make something that was comprehensible to police officers. One of the revelations out of the first task force is that officers, because they were confused, tended to over-report. When in doubt, they reported, including when they simply handcuffed someone. And so when we did the analysis of the data, we had to take all of that data out. It was really rather an over-reporting problem.
But wouldn't there be some occasions where I think it was in the report, the arm twisted behind the back. So that hurts.
That is...
Is that considered use of force or not?
If it is a control hold to handcuffing, we always twist someone's arm behind their back to get them in handcuffs. So you can presume there's some level of control and some level of pain compliance in this move to get someone into handcuffs. We are not categorizing that movement a use of force.
Okay. I, as we move forward, I think elements of pain as well as injury might. I know that's difficult. That's subjective, but it's of concern to me. I did want to comment that I note that you say that officer injuries decreased 16% after the force policy was instituted. We found something very similar in psychiatry and inpatient psychiatry, where we backed off and used other mechanisms to let people settle down. Both patient and staff injuries went down, and so it's interesting to see that correlation. And my final question is about pointing of firearms. Does that include pointing of tasers and pepper spray?
No, it includes neither pointing of tasers and pepper sprays. That was a change that I affected in reporting. We initially collected data on pointing a taser really to determine the effectiveness of a taser. We found in the rollout of the taser program that when we pointed a taser and activated the laser light, the red dot, in roughly 65% of the time, people surrendered and we got compliance. That was a measurement that we used to determine whether or not it was an effective implement. I am not categorizing pointing a taser as a use of force.
So as the auditor does the performance audit on that, again, coming from my experience, we found that use of tasers decreased once we required security officers to report when they drew their taser rather than when they used it. So that's something I think to continue looking at as you figure out what strategies are helpful in getting to the goal that we're all seeking. Thank you.
Commissioner Fish.
Ms. Baptista, a comment that often we hear at events like this where we are acknowledging a reduction in a complaint process involving the police is something along the lines of, is this as a result of some change in policy, or is it as a result of a lack of trust or confidence in the people who would otherwise be reporting? It's one of those questions that's almost impossible to answer. It is a regular feature of our hearings in these kinds of instances, and I want to give you a chance to address that first, if you would.
Well, you look at the use of force report here, and you see that the Bureau has put a tremendous amount of effort into reducing the amount of force used in the community. And so I think that we look at the downward trends in complaints following where the Bureau has put their efforts. I also think a good indicator is that, and we reported this in our annual report, that officers receiving multiple complaints has dropped significantly. I mean, I think that also goes to the point where the Bureau has been proactive of addressing the situation of those officers who receive multiple force complaints. And so, for example, in 2008, only two officers received multiple force complaints. And previous years, 16 or more officers received multiple force complaints. So I see the connection there as the Bureau looking for those officers who are generating those complaints and actually addressing the problem to reduce those complaints.
Other council discussion?
Just one other question, sorry. I remember, why are the use of force percentages highest in East at 29% and lowest in North at 10%? Why the difference between the different precincts?
I can't tell you. It could be the number of arrests. It could be the kinds of calls for service. It could be the culture of the precinct. I think it would require more study than we were able to do to tease that out.
I think that would be interesting if you've got three times as many use of force issues in East versus North. Why?
Well, and I think you know about some of the struggles that we have in East Portland in terms of it is a challenged precinct in terms of public safety at the moment. There are neighborhoods that I think are feeling under siege, and I think at least part of that would, I think, would factor into forced decision-making. But it's really hard on the spot to be able to say exactly how much.
It'll be interesting. I know you put such a lot of work into equalizing workload between the new three precincts once we do another. I presume there'll be another study next year. Is this an annual report that you do?
I think we plan to report annually, and it's a workload issue in terms of how much analysis time we can really put into an annual report.
I think we might
publish numbers 1 year and then in the succeeding years really be able to dig deeper.
It's really helpful to me, so thank you very much for the work that you've done on it.
And I think we haven't really made a decision about how often or what we'll revisit or if we'll go back and look at all 16 recommendations again. But I just wanted to point out that one of the values of this kind of information coming forward is that it raises these kinds of questions. And it allows auditor types like me to keep presenting the plug of using data, collecting data, and using it to manage your operation. So I'm very pleased to see this kind of ongoing review from the Bureau and from other bureaus who do the same. And I want to say one other thing before I leave the podium today, and that is how much I appreciate the hard work of the folks who worked on this report, and both the staff of IPR, the staff at the Bureau, and most importantly, I think, the citizens who participated. The Citizen Review Committee is a group of very dedicated volunteers who put in many, many hours every month reviewing the Bureau and offering guidance and advice to IPR. And I really appreciate Michael and Lauren Erickson, who also served on this particular task force, and the rest of the very active volunteers who participate. And I also want to put in a thank you to all of you for your efforts in helping us recruit new members. We had 18 or 19 folks apply. Some of that is the good work of Irene Konev, who is the outreach director for IPR now, but it's also your efforts as well. So thank you.
Thank you all very much. Appreciate your testimony and your work. Carol, how many people do we have signed up?
We have two people.
Okay.
Catherine Houston and Dan Handelman.
Ms. Houston, Mr. Handelman, welcome to the City Council. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Glad you're here. We just need your first and last name, and you'll have 3 minutes, and that clock on that big chunk of wood will help you keep track of the time.
Why is our time so limited to three? Although that's all you testified before the House and Congress, right? Continuity. My husband was arrested. That's too loud. My husband was arrested on July 3rd. Detained at Multnomah County. I was given a 6-month ban from the Inverness Jail. I've got DC or MCDC and MCIJ. Now, what I want to know is how does that serve my husband? We've been married. We got married June 20th. Today's the 23rd of July. How many days is that? 22? Or, 30? Now, the good news is I should be able to bail him out tomorrow, if not Monday. However, how in the hell does that serve him? Sheriff Jones was very aware. He's met me on a number of occasions. My husband was a paratrooper in Vietnam. How does a six-month ban from his wife serve either one of us or the community? A minute and 32 seconds. Now, I called Bob Skipper. That's one issue. The other issue is the use of handcuffs is very ridiculous. There are many times handcuffs aren't even used. You make a request of someone. If they comply, they comply. If they have MS, if they have broken bones, if they have inflammation of the joints, and your police officers and sheriffs don't know it, you have no idea what damage you're doing to the other human being. Now, there is a video recording of me being slammed down to the ground in your detention center. Now, the wonderful news is that Jim Willis will finally see the impact of gentlemen and females who get a piece of metal on their shirt, okay? We did the studies in 1960. And know what happens in the psyche. 30 seconds, 28 seconds. Now, I've already talked to, I've gotten no email addresses back from DAs, from Mr. Skipper, from the lady Elizabeth, I've got her name here somewhere, all who implemented this. Now, they're serving themselves. We have three sheriffs at the library, 600 people who got canceled visits during the week. So one sheriff can have his job.
Thank you very much for your testimony. We really appreciate it. Mr. Handelman.
Good afternoon, Mayor Adams and commissioners. I'm Dan Handelman with Portland Cop Watch. I appreciate the discussion today. Our organization prepared these comments, which we revised a little bit since we put them out on Monday. And then we also released some statistics that we got when I was on the Racial Profiling Committee that weren't included in the report. And we thought that those statistics tell a little bit, give a little bit more of the story that weren't given by the way the report was framed this time. I appreciate some of the discussion that's already happened that I was going to bring up some of these issues, such as the issue that Commissioner Fritz brought up about physical control. When somebody grabs your thumb and bends it, it really is incredibly painful. And the fact that that's not being counted now as a use of force means that we could be under-reporting now, even if we were over-reporting before. So I hope that we can find somewhere in the middle to get more statistics on when that kind of thing is happening, because I think that's the kind of thing that makes people feel the police use too much force. We urged the chief to continue to collect the information on laser light only, because when you see something pointing at you and a red dot on your chest, she said 65% of the time people back down. Well, I wonder if it's not a use of force, then what is it? If we are not the only city that keeps track of that, then so be it. Then we'll be the leader in the nation. But we should put that back on the form. That's a very serious use of force. Connected to that is this pointing of firearms, which happens 1,053 times compared to 1,385 other uses of force. That means 43% of the use of force is officers pointing their weapons at people. And anybody that takes a basic firearm safety class knows that you don't point a gun unless you're planning to use it. Like, if it goes off, you better be responsible for it. And there's no real discussion about why that happens so often. About the use of tasers, the fact that the use of tasers has been consistent across the years, the past several years, and not gone down, even though other short forms of force have gone down, is very of great concern to our group. One of the things that the report shows is that at least 61 times, people who were simply not complying with police orders got tasered. And that's not allowed by the police directive. And I asked the question at the CRC meeting whether they're going to investigate those 61 incidents as misconduct, and I didn't get a reply, so I'm hoping the council will ask about that. One of the main things we focus on, I'm glad to hear Chief Sizer saying that this is a compliment to the Racial Profiling Committee, because we've been asking for years, why is it that we have a 6% African-American population, but 29% of the force that's used in Portland is used against African-Americans? And then when you look at the pointing of weapons, the last report said 30% of people who had guns pointed at them were African-American, and this one says 34% of people who have guns pointed at them are African-Americans. And I know it's also been in the press that the amount of taserings of people with mental illnesses has gone up. We're very concerned about that because a lot of people who die after being tasered have mental illnesses. Amnesty International has reported on that. And we really are glad the auditor will be looking at the use of tasers. We just hope that there will be more serious studies, and we hope that the pledge to do this annually is kept.
Well, I want to, Mr. Hanneman, I want to acknowledge your ongoing efforts in this area, and your reports are very useful to me and my staff. I also want to note that you gave condemnations to Central Precinct and the Transit Division. So
commendations.
Commendations. What did I say?
I think you said condemnations.
Condemnations. Now there's a difference with the distinction.
Does he look like a sign?
No, sorry. Yeah. So you gave commendations to Central Precinct and the Transit Divisions, and I think it's helpful to note improvement where it happens in your eyes. So thank you.
Could I just get a clarification, Dan? You say in your report, your testimony, that the use of force is now being seriously underreported in the city of Portland. When did the change occur in reporting requirements, and so what period of time should we be looking at to verify that?
Well, the use of force form was changed in November of 2007. So it was just before this reporting period started. They actually started when the new reporting form went into place. The old report covered from 2004 to 2006. And actually, there's a year of statistics that we don't have access to because they weren't published in this report and there was not a report done last year. That's 2006 to 2007. We don't know what happened in that year. So then the 2007 to 2008 statistics you're looking at don't include the pointing of tasers, as I mentioned, and it doesn't include the control holds, which may be painful, but nonetheless didn't cause injury. So that's why I believe that it's being underreported.
And I'm intrigued by your argument about use of tasers and the light. Are there other jurisdictions where that particular data is collected and it is treated as a use of force?
Well, what the Bureau is saying is that there aren't any. What I'm saying is that we should do it. We did it before. We should continue to do it. They've separated out the pointing of firearms into a separate report for this, for the purposes of reading. So they think they can separate it out again here, even if it's not part of the aggregate data. Then if we start doing it here, maybe other bureaus will follow suit, and that way we can be a leader in the country.
Just help me understand one part of the, because I understand the difference between keeping track of the data and some basis to conclude that it is a use of force. Are there other jurisdictions that consider the pointing of a light on someone with a taser a quote-unquote use of force?
I don't know. I don't believe so, but I would hope they would, because it takes a conscious decision on the part of an officer to pull the trigger down halfway to light up that light. It's not just taking it out of the holster or even just pointing it. It goes beyond that. It's a pointing of it's one step behind launching those darts and knocking it to the ground with 50,000 volts.
So your argument is like the difference between assault and battery. Assault is the intent to do something. The battery is the actual item, actual action, and the light is in effect an action. I'm not saying it's an assault, but akin to an assault in that analogy.
Yeah, I think so, Mr. Attorney.
Covering attorney.
Yeah.
I'm just
still have a ways to go.
I'm trying to understand your argument.
Yeah.
I'm trying to understand whether there's other jurisdictions that have reached that conclusion that you're
right. I'll try to do my own research. I'm trusting the Bureau in this case where they say that nobody else collects it. My point is, I think that they should, and I think Portland should take leadership in that.
Thank you.
So,
thank
Dan,
you.
I have a quick question for
sure.
Dan. What should a citizen do if they feel that they've had an unreasonable use of force?
Well, we encourage people, as much as we think the System Review Committee and the IPR aren't as strong as a system as we think there should be, we encourage people to file their complaints for the IPR because that's the only way we can keep track of these things. And then they will do the intake, and then if there's a full investigation, of course, the police will still do the investigation, but at least it's a step up from not having somewhere to go.
Thank you.
Thank you both for your testimony. Really appreciate it. Anyone else signed up to testify?
Yeah. I'd like to explain to you the difference between the Northwest and the Southeast, so you don't need to waste another minute.